Hello, and welcome to another episode of Changes, a program from Chief Healthcare Executive. As the name strongly suggests, Changes is a program exploring the rapid changes taking place in the world of healthcare. I'm Ron Southwick, Lead Editor of Chief Healthcare Executive. We have a great conversation today. We talk with Matt Haywood, the President and CEO of Aspirus Health, a system operating 18 hospitals in Wisconsin and parts of Minnesota and Michigan. He talks about the need to recognize realities and be pragmatic in planning, and to prepare even at a time of rapid change. It's a great conversation. Thanks for joining us. How do you keep that forward momentum?
Yeah, I think for us, what we realized right coming out of COVID was just like everybody else, immediately coming out, I'll take me personally, and I'd say the organization, you're almost like worn out. So you're just like relief, and then you're like, okay, things are going to go back to normal. And I think a lot of people took longer to get through that cycle and realize maybe normal isn't coming back like the way we knew it to be. And we quickly realized normal wasn't coming back the way we thought it was. It was a little disheartening because you just got over COVID, you were worn out, you're tired. But we quickly started having discussions and using our foresight. And in doing so, though, what we found is when people were tired, people were struggling coming out of that tough time to tell them the world is not going back to normal, that you see a world with more challenges and more tough decisions needing to be made. It was hard messaging for our company. And when you try to talk to other people inside and outside, there's sometimes friction. There's sometimes, I don't want to accept that. And you have to be willing to overcome it, because if you have foresight and then people say, I don't like that world you're painting, I don't want to change, you can't do anything with it if friction stops you. Our organization is becoming very adept at willing to change. So we were able to take that foresight of the world we saw, deal with those emotions and that friction internally, maybe of not really being like, I'm believing that you got to have to do something again after you just got through COVID. And then we went and said, okay, let's use our fortitude. Let's have some willpower to get through these things. And we started doing it with a cycle now of being foresightful, knowing we're going to have to get through some frictions. Mainly now, the frictions are more external, because other parties outside may not see the world we see. And then we quickly get into the cycle of fortitude and then follow up, where we then, okay, say, let's do it. Let's follow up. Let's go. And we've been able to, I think, during these last 5 years, you see it in our quality, our service, our turnover, our engagement scores, our growth, and our finances. We didn't dip like a lot of other places. We had our dent that everybody went through during some of this, but we quickly came out faster and more robustly because we saw the future differently. And quite frankly, we've been more right than wrong. So that's probably worked in our favor, as we worked through not wanting to change because everybody was tired. And then we actually followed through with it. And I think that's shown up in Chippewa Falls. Our $257 million, one of the biggest construction projects in our history, we approved that and moved on that during this time, when other people were maybe hunkering down, because we saw a future 2 years ago, 3 years ago, where we saw inpatient growth as more of a growth plate than many other people. So we thought that was very helpful.
I remember in our first interview, you talked about the expectations for inpatient growth. So I was really glad you brought that up, because a lot of people are talking about moving care outside the hospital. And of course, there's a need for strong outpatient services. But you mentioned a couple years ago, with an aging population that's going to need more healthcare services, you saw a big possibility of a need for more inpatient demand. And that seems like what we might be seeing in the near future.
Yeah, it's actually, and you got to be proactive, because for Wausau Hospital, with that 250 something million dollar expansion, that's taking years to do. You just don't add, 70 something beds overnight. It takes years to do it. So if you aren't foresightful and moving on it. So right now Wausau is running 90% capacity, and that's after we've decompressed it using our region better and our new asset that we gained in Duluth. We've been pushing business to them. So we're finding that we're maxing out on the beds types that are needed. So it's been a good foresightful decision.
A lot of changes in federal health policy when there's just a lot of uncertainty in the marketplace. How do you maintain long-term planning at a time with a lot of uncertainty?
I think the first thing is we do a lot of environmental research as an organization. And then with that research, we look at scenario planning. I think a lot of people done it, but not as many do it as they say, and not many have done it as rigorously in the past. So we do that like almost like genetically, DNA wise. We do that all the time. And when you really go through all this chaos and you start taking these data points and you start doing some scenarios, you start realizing there's actually a core world that starts to form that isn't as chaotic and ununderstood as you might think. But it takes work to get through it. And then you got to have the foresight and the fortitude to go, oh my gosh, that's really not a pretty world. And you can't wish it away. And what we do is find that world, don't wish it away, and then go forward with it. And we're actually looking at 5 to 10 year plans now. And we see a world where we weren't surprised, frankly, by inflation sticking. We weren't surprised by what we would call post-COVID nationalism, where people started to break that world supply chain apart. We're not, quite frankly, surprised by the fact that America and its policies are more isolationist like than we used to be, more independent from working with our allies. We are not surprised by that world, and we see how it trickles. So we were prepared for a lot of what's going on. Now, do we know every little act and thing that would happen? No, but we had a rough idea. We also weren't surprised that the federal government was going to be very aggressive in reducing our reimbursement to us through the One Big Beautiful Bill and Medicaid, as well as we don't anticipate some other programs maybe not getting changed substantially. And the reason for that is we look at the government's funding. We're at $40 trillion deficits right now, running probably a $50 trillion deficit in the next 5 years total as a country. That's 120 some percent of GDP. When you're at that level of deficit structure, you can't. That's, our debt payments are our number one thing in our budget for the government. So in that world, you know government programs are going to get cut. So which ones are most likely? Which ones are the biggest ones? Healthcare, Medicare, Medicaid. Some of these programs are the biggest government expenditures besides Social Security and defense. So where are you going to cut? We got to assume healthcare is going to get in that crosshair. So when you start doing that and you go out and model, our system, which is $3 billion, has a $1 billion gap that we have to deal with over 10 years. And when we talk to other organizations, some of them think that's too pessimistic. Other ones don't go that far out. But we're like, so what happens if One Big Beautiful Bill doesn't get overturned? What happens if Medicare keeps giving us very limited raises, if any? What happens if Medicare cuts a program or changes a program? We keep having PAYGO totally passed and not actually implemented. What happens if the Medicare rate cuts and PAYGO get put in? So when you start running those scenarios and you throw in inflation, which is actually the biggest lever here, when you start throwing all that together and you put it in a scenario, the reality is we got to find out how to become $1 billion more efficient over 10 years through cost, growth, operational changes. And if you don't start today for some of this, you won't be able to get it later. So that level of foresight is needed. And I think you could plan through that chaos, is my point.
A lot of people looking at AI to help deal with some of these changes, help improve efficiencies. How do you approach AI and why do you suggest that it may be helpful, but not necessarily the panacea that some people are projecting it to be?
As I talk to other people, I'm always a learner. I'm not one who thinks I have it all. So I always am trying to. Now, I have to have foresight and be decisive as a leader for our organization to be able to get through that chain of foresight, friction, fortitude to follow up and deliver. You can't be undecisive with the knowledge that you think you might have. Now, you got to be willing to pivot when you think you're wrong. So, in that world, I've always been asking, especially with AI, am I being biased by my own view of the world? Am I creating a view that may not be accurate? So I always ask a lot of other people, try to talk to other people. And the first thing I find when I talk with other people is there's this first reaction is the world's too chaotic, I can't plan. And you just heard my argument, I think you can. And then when I push, can you plan? And then I talk about this billion-dollar gap. And then some other organizations are starting to do this, and some have done it earlier, some are doing it now. They're starting to struggle with, I got this gap of some magnitude, Matt. Maybe I'm only looking 5 years, but I see a gap too. Now we're all starting to do the analysis and see the gap. When I look at that gap, I am a pragmatist and I say, I can't wish it away. I can't hope it away. What do I think really is going to happen? And so when I look at that gap, my first thing is going to things I know I can control. So we're working hard on knowing operational improvements, knowing standardization that doesn't require AI. That's the first step. Don't run to AI as it's going to help right away. Second is when you're in a very tough environment, unless you're a very big company with a lot of margin, you can't take a lot of bets and hope every bet plays out. And that's where it feels like when I talk to people, they're doing this with AI. They're saying, I got this, I got that, I'm trying this, I'm trying that. And I feel sometimes that we're a little bit more pragmatic. And so the reason I would say we're pragmatic is, and it's starting to pan out, is there's been some articles written recently as the hype has started to die down a little bit. It's still there, but nowhere near where it was a year or so ago. Like MIT has said, 95% of all these kind of pilots and tests of AI have proven to have no ROI. And so we can't afford, if we're in the environment I'm talking about, to and being pragmatic, we can't afford to test pilot 10 things and have no ROI. So what we've decided is we're going to be following these following rules. One, we're going to realize we got a problem. We're not going to wish it away. We're not going to think the government's going to change it. We're going to, two, follow a rigorous approach to try to improve our organization. Three, we do not believe AI is not going to help, but we believe it's going to help in two tranches. And even if it helps in two tranches, it's still not going to be the saving grace. It'll be a tool that will help. Tranche one, we believe, is what we call enabling technology. So that enabling technology for us is knowing technology that is AI enabled and is got an ROI and it's been out at least for a couple years and tested. So an example is we're calling that enabling technology because it's known, it's used, and it has an ROI that others might have tested five versions of it before it got to this better version. Let them test it. We'll be a fast follower. So we are using the term enabling technology and fast follower. And a great example of this, Ron, is ambient listening, one of the premier healthcare AI things that everybody says AI is great at. Everybody will say that. Nobody's going to argue that. We wouldn't argue that. However, what we would argue is, okay, it came out. It's been out in various iterations for years, but it's now getting at a really good level with AI. And by waiting 2 years, 3 years maybe, so we're not like way behind, but we're not this leading, bleeding edge. By being a fast follower, the technology went from an independent app tied to your EMR that was being charged to you for $1,500 a doc. It wasn't perfect, but it was good. Now, only 3 years later, that technology is no longer an independent app. We could buy it within Epic today for $70 a doc. So in 3 years, it's gone from an app that's outside your stack for $1,500 a doc to three in your stack for $70 a doc. That level of price drop and that level of integration change happened in just 3 years. Now, if I would have bought that product 3 years ago and implemented it, I would be in a 7-year contract now, paying multiples of what I could pay today, and it would be outside my stack and it wouldn't be as integrated in my processes. Then I'd have to rip it out when I get out of my contract and then probably go into the Epic product. So that level of a wasteful usage of our dollars is not the best use of a dollar when you're in this world we just talked about. So we're going to be enabling technology, fast followers. That's bucket one. And that's not what a lot of people would argue. They would say, I don't know if I agree with that, Matt, but that's where we're leaning towards. Bucket two is we're saying we need to. Oh, so, sorry. Before I go to bucket two, there's another thing I'm finding in bucket one that a lot of people are doing different than us. In bucket one, a lot of people are piloting across various things. So they got people saying, I got this product I want you to test. Staff saying, I want this product test. We're not going at it that way. What we're saying is we're going to look at, based on enabling technology definition, where in our company do we have operational issues that we could fix with known technology is not the way we're starting this. We're starting with, we have problems in our company. Where can we improve this company? Then we do a value analysis of the how the company's like area works. So let's use RevCycle. We'll go through RevCycle and say, here's how RevCycle works. How can we make RevCycle more efficient? Oh, by the way, is there enabling technology out there? And can we start fixing parts of RevCycle with that enabling technology? And what we're trying to do is we're trying to scale the use of AI technology across RevCycle for like five or six programs, not have an AI program in RevCycle, another AI program in supply chain, another one over here. We're concentrating it to solve a problem with known technology that's been at least out in the market for a year or so. So that level of focus is allowing us to get the best price, best product, and concentrate the value of that product. So that's what we see the next 0 to like say 3, 4, 5 years being. And that's mainly going to be a little bit in clinical, definitely a lot in the back office area. Then we see transformative stuff happening, and we don't know exactly what that is because the world's still building it. And we're trying to go out there, and this is where we're placing our bet and say, we think we got five areas we want to do things differently. Example, we believe in 5 years or more that all our like 50% of all our primary care visits could be done by an AI agent, not a primary care doc, versus a primary care doc will do a higher level primary care visit versus a basic primary care visit. How could we prepare for that world? So when you start making those kind of theoretical transformational scenarios, we're then going to work our way back and say, what do we got to do today with some of this enabling technology and work to build our way to that future state? So when it comes, we're ready to jump on it. So we see two pieces to this AI change, a more pragmatic, fast follower, enabling technology version, and then a transformative version. And we're trying to bridge the two and put them together. And again, when I talk to people, they might be doing this, but they might not. But nobody's articulating it very clearly that way to me when I talk. I hear more, we're piloting, we're trying this, we're trying that. I don't hear a more regimented structural approach. And we believe we have to have that because we have this bigger problem and we have very little room for error. And the final statement I'd make is if it hits it out of the ballpark, okay, and I'm just using a very basic kind of like framework. And say we have 14,000 employees and say how we transform somehow so much that we can reduce 1,000 employees. That's only like $100 million. It's not going to be a billion. We got a $1 billion problem. So while I see AI being transformative in the way I just said, and in the timeline I said, I don't think it's going to fix our $1 billion problem. It's going to help, but isn't going to fix it. We're going to have a lot of other work. And when I talk to other people, again, they might be doing this. They just don't articulate it that way to me. So I don't know if they really are, or if they just aren't articulating it to me effectively, or I just don't see what they're saying. But so I think we are somewhat unique. Now, we're not alone in some of this, but I do think we're somewhat unique in our approach to this, when I talk to others at least.
A lot of hospitals and health systems are worried about Medicaid cuts are going to unfold in the coming years. How are you preparing for those changes in Medicaid programs are going to unfold over the next decade?
Like I said, we were not surprised that it was going to happen about a year or so ago. We actually budgeted for them. They're actually happening slower than we anticipated. And we budgeted for them. The ACA subsidies going away. We budgeted for uncompensated care going up. We've been budgeting and planning for another governmental program getting hit, like PAYGO starts to actually be enacted or site neutrality hits. We've been modeling those out and planning for them and preparing for that, Ron, first you have to do the modeling. You have to basically take the shock and awe of what it tells you, because you can't. We call it looking through the keyhole versus opening the door. Most people will look through the keyhole and say, I can't think out farther than at most 5 years. And when you do that, the way the One Big Beautiful Bill is written, your problems don't look too bad because they don't start it until 2028. All these things just kind of slowly trickle in. So when you look through the keyhole for 5 years, you're like, oh, this isn't too bad. Okay. What I did was I said, blow the door open, guys. And we did that. And you go out 5 years past that, you're like, holy moly. You see the One Big Beautiful Bill really hit. So then you say to yourself, well, are they going to repeal it? Is something going to change if a new president comes or a new Congress? I'm saying, due to my budget argument for the federal government, I don't think you're going to easily repeal this. So I think we got a plan to be stuck with it. So then when you open the door and you look past that first 5 year tranche, it's a $1 billion problem. So that means you got to start doing things now along the lines of everything we said, so you can prepare for that time. Because what I think a lot of people are going to get bit by is, and I'm seeing it starting to happen right now, is if you don't think far enough out, Ron, what happens is everybody's used to creating a budget. I'm just assuming everybody does. Not everybody does, but let's assume everybody does. When you create a budget, what you do is you go ahead and you say, we got a problem. We're not making it. So you cut some programs here or there. You change some things. Maybe don't give us bigger raises, whatever you do to get to that budget. What happens is, in the world that's coming up now with inflation, these cuts with the federal government, every budget year gets harder and harder in this modeling. In this world. And if you're coming to each budget year at the time and you have 6 months to build your budget out, some of the things you can't do in 6 months, you can't solve. So if you aren't thinking about a problem 3 years from now and starting to deal with it today, like rev cycle, if we want to get better rev cycle efficiency and it's going to save us $30 million, say, I might need to do all that work we talked about, value chain analysis, create areas where we want to put AI in, get that operational concentration of AI products to get that value. If I don't start that today, I won't get that 40 million or whatever that number is for 3 years later. And if I wait to 6 months before that budget's due and I try to figure out how I'm going to make my budget, I can't do that work. Now, in the old world, when inflation was lower, you didn't have the One Big Beautiful Bill and these cuts and changes, and your revenue was growing at 2%, you could always come in 6 months before your budget and tweak things. In today's world, if you aren't thinking out and preparing today for 3 years out, when your budget's got to be built 3 years out, I am preparing for 3 years out. I already got this budget, next budget already done at a high level. We're worrying about budget year three now. And what do we got to do operationally to make sure we can make that budget? And then we're doing it at a high level all the way out for 10 years. And we're working towards that. So if you don't think that way in today's world, you aren't going to be able to put an AI agent or an AI product in 6 months before your next budget, and all of a sudden, miraculously, you're going to make your budget. So I think it's going to be a lot more foresight, fortitude, tough decisions, a lot more standardized rigor, and you're going to have to think a lot further out, no matter how chaotic the world is.
See the potential of having to reduce services or maybe even close some facilities as these cuts unfold in the coming years?
I would say you can never say never, Ron. I think our view is we would say this. Our job is to be foresightful, have the ability to deal with the friction, the fortitude, and the follow-up and the rigor to ensure that we are there for our communities and we can absorb and deal with these challenges and they never know about it and their care never changes. Now, if we do all that well, that still does not mean that if we're foresightful, that we don't change the way we do services. We don't find that a certain community's needs are different now as the population ages or shrinks or grows. And as we learn that, we will maybe have to make changes to services, but we frame it as not closing. We frame it as remodeling the care of service for the area or market because it's changing. So if a community is shrinking from 10,000 to 2,000, they may not need a hospital. They might need more of an outpatient center if they have access to a hospital 30 miles away. So there are certain things we might have to do a little differently. And We might not be able to, with the world that we have, to be able to provide physicians at certain sites. It may have to be remote, like with AI, or it might be telehealth. So I think the way care is going to be delivered definitely will change. So I think the people have to be prepared. The way the world was is not going to be the same, but it doesn't mean we won't still give you great care and be there for our communities.
It feels like a lot of what you've talked about is planning for the worst, not necessarily from a pessimistic view, but a pragmatic approach.
Yes. And I would say, unfortunately, Ron, we've been more right than wrong on the view of the future. And I know it's sometimes I'm considered to be Mr. Bleak, but it's the reality of you got to be pragmatic. And I hate to say it, not every picture is rosy. And if you try to make it rosy artificially, and I've talked to some people are betting on the one big beautiful bill being repealed. I don't know if I want to bet our company and our community's care on that. Especially when you talk about the federal government's deficits, like we talked about. So I think I know I call myself a hopeful positive pragmatist. My team may not agree, but
I know we're getting really near the end of our window, but what haven't we talked about that you wanted to hit on? You've covered a lot of ground and some
I
really
know.
interesting stuff, but what do we not want to leave off the table?
Actually, only thing I would probably not want to leave without saying is that all the things we talked about, you can't do it without creating a really good culture and getting the right people and making sure that the culture and those people bond and create the ability to do everything we've said. Is I really, when you look at what I'm most proud of over my, gosh, it's probably going on 13 or 14 years, is that we really created a culture here at Aspirus where the ability to have foresight that may not be overly optimistic sometimes, to have people deal with friction when other people don't want to change, but we're willing to change. And then having the fortitude as an organization and the passion for what we do, and to actually do what we do and become, if you look at us on any metric, Ron, we are a top performing organization in the country. And in fact, when we start looking at that, benchmarking ourselves with the data that we're now able to access with artificial intelligence, we're shocked by how well we perform. And I think it's almost a humble surprise that our organization realizes that this culture and the people that we have gotten to such a point. We are one of the top performing health systems in the country. And that, frankly, it's something we should be proud of. And then it's something we should celebrate. But what it also scares us is when we have a $1 billion problem and we bring an outside consultant in and they say, well, you can't find opportunities to improve in 75% of the areas they looked at and said, you're the highest performing organization we've seen. It's rewarding, makes you feel good, but then it scares you because then you're like, well, where are we going to find our opportunities? And then you have to start thinking, like I'm talking about with you, you have to start thinking longer term out. You got to start thinking more robustly because you're not going to easily fix it with productivity, length of stay reduction, and some of those things that all the other people might be able to do, maybe. We're struggling to do that. We can't. We're pretty good on those. So we got to look at it in a more robust way. So it's good to have that pride. It's a little scary when you realize then you have less areas to improve
Yeah.
in a world we just had. Yeah.
Yeah. Nice to know that you're doing the right things, but also a little disturbing that doesn't really solve your problem. So,
Yeah. When you got more coming. So,
yes.
but I think we got a culture that accepts that though. One of the things outsiders come in and find, and I think I'll end with this most important point, it's all worthless if you don't have a culture and people that do anything with all these thoughts. So I could have these thoughts, but if I don't have a really good organization with a good culture and a good team that does something with it, it's worthless. And I give our team and our culture a lot of credit.